Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. In this episode, I sit down with actor, writer, and show creator Sam Richardson. You know, there are a lot of nasty, cynical people in politics and on HBO's Veep. In this episode, I'm not talking to any of them. My guest is Sam Richardson, who plays Richard T. Splett, although his middle name is John, the only enthusiastic idealist on the show's fictional White House staff. He was only supposed to do a single episode of the show, so I had to ask him how he wound up staying and holding his own among one of the most talent-packed casts on TV. And now, Sam has his own show, Detroiters, on Comedy Central. It draws on his love for his hometown, his unique take on sitcom relationships, and his nostalgia for really bad television commercials. But mostly, it draws on his live stage work and uncanny radar for truth in comedy. He says it comes from seeing what his characters can't. The process of creating characters and moments that connect with the audience in real time will always be a mystery to me. But Sam had some fresh light to shed on the topic. He also has one of the best How Did Your Parents Meet stories I've ever heard. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hey, Sam.
Hey, Sam.
You know, Sam's a good solid name. Do you like your name?
I do. It's a short, ends with like a strong M.
And yet it's not that common, right?
Right, because it's not like a John, like a Chris or a Matt. Sam is like just rare enough that it's still like a cool name, but it's simple.
Well, fellow Sams of the world unite. Yeah. Okay, so I'm happy to have you on here because I am such a fan of Veep, and I found out about you. And that show is, you know, in terms of comedy on television, it has its own tone, it has its own style. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I want to ask all about that, but I just saw your new show. Well, you wrote it, created it, you star in it. It's called Detroiters.
Yes.
And I'm never a laugh-out-loud person.
Yeah.
As I watch television. I'm just not. I don't sit in a room by myself and laugh out loud.
Yeah.
This show, there was a few moments that really got me laughing. And it's really funny. It's really original.
Thank you.
Takes place in Detroit.
In Detroit.
Where you're from.
Uh-huh.
With Tim Robinson, who's a Saturday Night Live writer.
Yep.
So I want to talk all about that. But I wanted to start with the fact that as a person who my whole life has been spent trying to come up with ideas. As a photographer, I was always trying to come up with the idea that told a story in a humorous and witty way. As a music video director, as a cartoonist, I really identified with scenes of you two guys trying to come up with ideas. And and just to catch people up really quick, the show is basically if Mad Men took place in Detroit. And instead of being the top New York ad agency, it was like the lowest Detroit ad agency that made the late night commercials with, you know, the used car salesman guy and the hot tub guy. And you guys play creative. So what I wanted to ask you about was how many parallels you found to your own life in terms of having to be in that room and come up with an idea.
Well, that's why we decided to make these guys ad men, because there's so many parallels there to like comedy writing and like sketch writing. You know, Tim wrote on SNL, you know, when we both wrote at Second City, and we performed at Second City together in Detroit and Chicago. So like, we have this experience of writing comedy. There's more of a blue collar working feel to these guys being ad men, but the parallels are
rather than just being sketch comedy guys.
Just being sketch comedy guys is not as accessible, I think. And then, you know, then you are being funny about being funny, which is like a hat on a hat. You
right, know? A hat on a hat.
A hat on a hat, which is a funny image itself. But so like with the parallels, it's like the idea is that you pitch your idea, like you do in sketch writing or comedy. You pitch and you're like, how about what if there's a dog and this dog thinks it's a cat? You pitch. And then like, it was like great, either, you know, accepted or rejected, just like in comedy. And then you go from there and you start to write, you brainstorm, just like whatever ideas come out. Then you deal with rejection from the client or the room or whatever, which I think is the same in comedy, you know? Like, you're just trying to create, you're trying to like make something. And then you spend all night trying to come up with ideas and all nighter where you're just trying to write and just get your ideas on the paper. And then instead of like performing a sketch or filming a sketch, instead this is like filming a commercial. You know, so in the show, the commercials serve as sketches, but they're not like jokey commercials because our characters aren't out there for the joke. They right. think that they're doing high art.
Right, exactly. yeah. Exactly. Well, it's interesting because I'm sure you've had the same experience as me. There's nothing lonelier than being in a room and you have to come up with an idea and you're in there by yourself and you've got the blank page feeling going on. And you have described in interviews, you've described Tim as your best friend.
Yeah.
And as an adult, you have this best friend. And I think that's like the secret dream of all artists is, could we have a best friend that we could do this with, mm-hmm. that when we don't have an idea, the friend can maybe come up with something that sparks us. So tell me about how you met and how you discovered you were best friends and how you sort of like found common ground.
He was my level A teacher at Second City.
Oh, he was?
Uh-huh.
Is he that much older than you?
No. He was like, I was super young. I was in classes and I was like 19 when I started taking like really like getting into Second City classes, and he was 21.
Oh, wow.
You know? So, okay. we became fast friends. So, like, I think we just like realized our sensibilities were the same. So, you know, you can like, kind of like, we developed like a shorthand so quick.
Is that something that is really, really prized in a sketch comedy sort of environment when you find that sort of?
Yeah, it absolutely is. Because like, you know, especially if you're improvising, because the idea is that you want to make your partner look good, you know? So you want to provide them with the means to have them like reach their goal, you know? So like to play a great straight man, you know, you need to ask the right questions, or like you need to like get out of the other person what would be funny, so they're not always like, and another thing, So it's great to, if you have a shorthand like that, you can know kind of what things that they're trying to go for, and then like can smooth the path for them so that they don't have to do their setup, their punch. You don't have to pre-plan it. You can just kind of feel where the joke is going. And also it's not about seeing, or what joke is he trying to do? You can pass and receive like the ball, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Do you remember an early example of a sketch you guys did together that worked really well and it sort of surprised you?
Yeah, we did a show at Second City. I played this character named Keith, who was a security guard at the United Center, and he played a basketball fan who was just trying to come in and audition for the team.
Right.
He wanted to come in and play the team. Like, you can't come in here. Can't come in here. Why can't I come in here? You can't come in here. Why can't I come in here? I'll be your best friend. All right, come on in here. So like these two just dummies who find each other and find love. You know what I mean? They love each other immediately, and then just became best friends. So like the idea of like this, these two adults who have this childlike love, was something we found early, and it's like a theme of ours as friends.
That's funny because that theme seems to come up in the show.
It does
very much. So how did you guys like? Was there a desire to sit down and come up with a show?
Well, Tim and I had come up through the comedy scene in Detroit together. Then we both moved to Chicago, joined the touring companies. Then we're on the main stage together. We wrote together. Then Tim went out to New York because he got cast in SNL. Later became a writer. And then I moved out to Los Angeles and started working. So like the whole time though, and even when we were in Chicago, we were like, we just want to come back to Detroit. We want to bring something back to Detroit. We want to go to Detroit. But we want to go back with something. We don't just like show up and be like, nah, we gave up. So here we are back home. What's going on? What's cooking, Mom? So we'd always talked about that, like, oh, wouldn't it be fun to do this? Wouldn't it be fun to do this? Then Jason Sudeikis was with Tim in New York and said, why don't you and Sam do a show together? And we're like, yeah, sure, that sounds great. No, do it, and I'll produce it. So we got on the phone and said, let's do a show together. And I was like, yes, we've got to do this show. And from the get-go, we were like, well, it's just got to be about us and our friendship. It's got to be about, because like how much we love each other, you know, and how much fun we have, this got to be it. And then also it's got to be about Detroit, because it's all we ever talk about. And like, the things between that we kind of tried to find on how to tell that story kind of changed as we went. Like at first we were like, maybe these guys work as a parking lot attendant, you know, so okay. These two guys would be like in a booth and just like the idea is like how close together we were, and like we just go off on wacky adventures. But it's like that doesn't really show the world. You know, we want to like just absorb like our view of Detroit and show Detroit in a positive light, which it never is on television.
Yeah, yeah.
So like we found this ad man thing because it, you know, like we find the local commercials of Detroit so endearing that that these that we're like, well, how about these guys are the ones who put so much love into these commercials that are low budget, and these guys are punching out of their weight class. But then that's also speaks to like that Detroit spirit of like this indomitable will. You know, they just don't give up.
So when you came across that idea, did it immediately feel like that's the one?
It was like, that's it. That's
really?
It, absolutely.
Because it's funny, in the show, there's, you know, you have that moment. There's a certain slogan that you come up with for Chrysler. And it's kind of a transcendent moment in the show because you're watching a comedy, but when you come up with this idea for Chrysler, it's a really great slogan.
Yeah.
And it's that moment of, oh, we got it. And I think that there's something about that feeling as a creative person that is, there's nothing like it. Like
yeah, exactly.
When you know you've hit on something original. So tell me what the process happens from when you get that idea. How do you guys go about turning that spark into an actual script?
Well, we created the show with two other people also, mm-hmm. with Joe Kelly and Zach Cannon. And we find that idea, and then, so great, we know the world that we're going to set this in. What's the next step is to just kind of draw from our experiences. So then we start telling stories about like Tim and I, like things that have happened to us in our past, like things that are true of us. What kind of people are we? What kind of people, how do we react to things? And that kind of filters itself out into like these just storyboards. We're like, well, maybe something about this, or like, and also what are Detroit experiences?
So like a note card with
exactly.
About and what like, one might what might a note card say?
A note card might say, "Tim's a terrible wingman." And Tim is a terrible wingman. So you know, like
in real life, on the show,
like we do, we do our shows at Second City, and Tim's married with kids. Is married to his high school sweetheart. So you know. Very loving, very...
No wingman experience.
Also, he just wants to hang out with his friend.
Right.
So we would do our show at Second City, and I'm single, so I'm like, oh, great. Afterwards, we'd go across the street, go to the bar, and people would see us in the show, and then they'd come to talk to us. Like, what better lead-in than having performed like a three-hour
right.
show, and a beautiful woman comes up and is like, hey, I saw your show. And I'm like, oh, great. And Tim would be like, great, thanks, thank you. Yeah, I'm trying to talk to my friend, but thank you. And they'd be like, oh, sorry. And I'd be like, Tim, you're married. I'm not married. Stop doing this. Says, Tim doesn't, like, he just doesn't think that way.
So in a way, these note cards, they collect these little aspects of your friendship and personality.
Exactly.
Are those kind of the building blocks of maybe we can use this here, or maybe we'll save it for another show?
Yeah, exactly. Like maybe we can use this here, or if we're doing a show about like, let's say like another note card might say Woodward Dream Cruise. Like if we want to do something about the Woodward Dream Cruise.
What's the Woodward Dream Cruise?
The Woodward Dream Cruise is it's time in the summer. It's like a weekend long event where everybody brings out their like souped up hot rods and like their old classic cars, and they drive up and down Woodward Avenue. It's like just a classic car parade, essentially. So we're like, well, maybe we find some way to set something there. And like just the idea of Dream Cruise is maybe hard to make a TV show episode about it. So then we kind of have to try and like dig into it and say, like, what's the notion between Tim and Sam? Like, what are they trying to do in this? And that episode, I think we start selling T-shirts also, because have you seen the Detroit Hustles Harder shirt?
Yes, I have.
Detroit versus everybody.
Yeah.
Well, these guys for sure would try and do that as well.
Right. So they come up with a slogan.
They come up with their own slogan and they try and sell these shirts. So like that storyline, you can also fold it into the Woodward Dream Cruise, and you fold it into these other things. So they start to lay across each other.
Uh-huh.
And so then pretty soon you've got more than that's for a script. For a TV show script, half-hour show is about 22 minutes if you had commercials.
Right.
And that's 22 pages, like, in the script.
Sure.
The idea is, like, a one page equals 1 minute on screen. So, but, like, with all these ideas, you start to have, like, 35 pages, 40 pages. So then it goes from, like, this wealth of ideas that having to, like, kind of kill your darlings and be like, well, these are all fun and we all love all these jokes, but what is the clearest path?
I would think that the pilot would have a lot of pressure on it to set up the story correctly too, right?
Right, and that's the thing about pilots is that in a pilot, you're trying to introduce so many things. You're trying to introduce the audience to the characters. You're trying to show what they do. You're trying to show who they are, who's around them, what they want, what they don't have, what they need, what they're not aware of, what they they don't right. have. And that's all like within a half an hour. And then you've got to also make the story compelling and interesting enough to like, you know, to make you care about these characters
yeah.
and have a beginning, middle, and end. So it's kind of hard to do, and people feel like sometimes it feels like a little bit shackling by all these things, because you can't just be like, about this and this pilot, they go and they buy a duck.
So tell me, when you put this first pilot together, how far along was it before you take it out and shop it as a pitch? Was it just an idea? Was it a script?
We actually pitched just on the pitch. So we sold the show on the pitch to Comedy Central.
So how involved was that pitch?
Pretty involved. We had like examples of like our friendship. We had examples of like things about Detroit.
Did you say this is what's going to happen in the pilot? And did you map out the season a little bit?
Yeah, exactly. We would say this is where we want the show to go. And this is the kind of the things that we want to show over the course of a season. And this is the inspiration for this show. And this is the city of Detroit. We want to give it this positive light. And Comedy Central was very gung-ho about it.
And were they the first place you went?
We went to a few places.
But so you pitched it. You went around, did your pitch. And did the pitch get better?
It did.
Isn't that funny? There's so many parallels to what the guys are doing in the show.
Yeah, exactly.
So when you go out and pitch, it's probably better not to go to your target place first.
First, yeah.
Because you want to see how... Like,
yeah.
Is there a similarity to getting a sketch or a scene on its feet? Is it similar that you can't really know until you have an audience reaction? I'm so fascinated
yeah,
by that being good in a room and being able to win over a room and what you guys learn from that process.
Yeah. And it's funny, like on that point, like There's something to both sides as far as like performing a sketch or like an improv scene, like re-improvising, because there's so many moments that you find that are like so authentic in the moment the first time you do it, that you know that then you try and go back and try and recreate them. And I mean, that's what a good actor does, is they can recreate a moment and make it feel like it's the first time, or make it seem like they've only just come up with it.
Right.
But there is something like real and natural about especially in comedy, when you discover something and you get the audience reaction to it, it's like so unique about comedy and like sketch comedy and improv, is that the feedback is right there.
Yeah.
And there's no better indicator on how well you're doing
right.
or how poorly you're doing than you say something and, ha ha, okay, that works. And follow this path.
You know what I always think about is the Seinfeld episode where they go to sell the show about nothing.
Yeah.
And once they actually sell it, and then they have to write it. And they look at each other like, I don't think they planned on getting far enough. Like, did you ever feel that, like, once you actually sold it, was it like, oh, God, now we have to actually write the thing we pitched?
Yeah, like, once you're, like, there writing it, you're like, there's so many, like, pressures. Because also, like, we named this show Detroiters.
It's a great name.
At the same time, like, you take on, like, this responsibility, like, I'm speaking for the city of Detroit.
Yeah.
So we're like, oh, we got to get this right. We got to get the tone right, because it's got to feel. I've got to be proud of it. And if I'm from Detroit, I want to. If I wasn't the creator of the show and I watched the show and I'm from Detroit, I want somebody to take ownership of it.
Yeah.
To feel like this is an accurate portrayal. And it was, like, you know, one of the top cities of the world.
Right.
For a time. And so like, it's a place that's never lost that spirit. And so I think anybody from Detroit also feels that. If you walk in the street anywhere and say Detroit, you wear a Detroit t-shirt, someone will be like, Detroit, man, right? You from Detroit? And then you are in it.
And do you think that comes from how hard it was hit when the auto industry went away? And
yes.
Why did you live in Detroit? What did your parents do?
My father's from Detroit. My mother's from Ghana, actually. But my father's from Detroit and like was born and raised there. And, you know, it's the Detroit pride. He was a restaurateur.
Oh, yeah?
Retired. He owned, like, a few restaurants in Detroit. He had an African restaurant, because my mom's Ghanaian, so he opened that. And then eventually he opened an Outback Steakhouse
really?
As well in Southfield. Yeah, like, where else would you want to go? It's kind of the notion to live.
So your mother's side in Ghana, coming from a higher level of, like, because I read this about you,
oh, okay.
that you
yeah.
came from a family that had royal ties.
And my grandfather was a chief.
So that must be an interesting thing for her to come from that world and live in Detroit,
live
right?
In Detroit, yeah.
How did your mom and dad meet?
My dad, one day his phone rings, and he answers it, and it's like, is Sarah there? So who? Is Sarah there? No, sorry, wrong number. Oh, because I just got I was supposed to call Sarah. I just landed from Africa. My dad's like, Africa? He talks to this woman on the phone for an hour. And finally he's like, you know what, I'm gonna come pick you up. So he drives to the airport, picks this woman up from the airport. On the drive back, she's like, you've gotta go to Africa. You've gotta go to Africa. It's incredible. You just travel all around. It's amazing. And when you go look for this man, his name is Mr. Wiafi. He loves Americans. Find him. So my dad, very impulsive, he's like, all right. And he goes to Africa, travels all around West Africa.
Based on this stranger.
Based on this stranger and like this just thread. He's like, great, this sounds so cool. I'll go. Goes to Africa, travels all around West Africa, finally ends his time in Ghana where she told him to go and looks for Mr. Wiafi at the end of his trip. Finds this, looking for the Mr. Wiafi. Hey, Wiafi. Yeah, Wiafi, big man. Hey, Wiafi. So he finds this like office building, which is Wiafi's building. Goes in, says, I'm here to see Mr. Wiafi. talks to the secretary. She's like, oh, okay. He's in a meeting, but he wants to talk to you, so why don't you wait here? So my dad chats up the secretary. He's like, ah, cool. Finally, he's like, okay, he's ready to see you. So he goes up, talks to Mr. Wiafi. He's like, oh, wow, Lamar, I'm so excited to meet you. But I'm so busy, but I love Americans, and I wanted to talk to you. Why don't you come to my house for dinner? So he goes, he's like, okay, great. Makes his way out. On his way out, he talks to the secretary. He's like, look, I'm in town for like another week. Why don't we get dinner sometime? She's like, sure. So he goes to Mr. Wiafi's house, is led into the house, and Mr. Wiafi is sitting at the dinner table with his wife and his son and two daughters, one of whom was the secretary, and it was my mom.
You're kidding.
So then they spent the rest of the week together, like every day. Then he had to go back to Detroit, she stayed in Ghana, but they would meet up in London and then go back and meet up
in London. So they had their courtship long distance like that?
Courtship long distance.
Amazing.
In the most like romantic way. And then finally asked her to marry him, so they moved back to Detroit.
So when you were young, did you go back and forth?
I did. I used to go back and forth like twice a year.
Oh, really?
I'd go like every summer to the point where I was like annoyed by it. Because, like, you know, you'd be in school year all the time. It's like, oh, what are you going to do this summer? I don't know. And, like, they'd never tell me where we're going. So I was like, here we go, summertime, in the D. And I'm like, oh, pack your bag. We're going to Ghana tomorrow. And I'm like, just, all right.
Right, you're a kid. You just want to be around
your
friends.
I want to go to Cedar Point. You know what I mean?
But that must have given you a different perspective on your own life.
For sure it did. And then for first and second grade, I lived in Ghana.
Oh, you did?
I did. And that perspective on my own life and then, like, my life in Detroit. Well, first off, to my cousins, my American cousins, I was like the African kid. And to my African cousins, I was the American kid.
Isn't that funny? You know? I wonder what that did for your identity, because a black man or a black boy in Detroit has such a different self-identification self-identity than being a majority in Africa,
exactly.
Right?
Because like in Africa, you know, as a kid, you look and you're like, oh, everybody's black. The president is black. The taxi cab driver is black. So there's not the idea that if you're black, you can't do this. The classification for what you can do isn't based on the color of your skin, you know? But then you come to Detroit. However, Detroit being majority black also, that exists there too. Like, mayor is black, you know?
But it's different, right?
But it's different because you're in America where...
There's the white world and the black world.
The white world and the black world.
And
the class
you're a minority.
System is based on your color.
So how did that change your perspective? Because I have to bring up, there's an interesting characterization that your character has in Detroiters. You imagine everybody is black before you meet them. And in the scene, there's a woman and you know her by reputation, but you never met her. And you say, oh, I pictured you as black. And then Tim says, he pictures everybody as black. And it makes you stop and go, well, yeah, why wouldn't he picture everyone as black? He's black. That's the way he sees the world. And it comes up again in a bit of a callback later. But it stops and makes you think. And it's a little bit subversive, I think, in this comedy, that it's like challenging people to go, well, yeah, that's totally a valid perspective.
Yeah, exactly. To me, being black isn't an extra thing. It's the normal, you know?
Was that something you wanted to include in the show from the start?
Very much. And like, it was very important to me that Detroit be represented you know, Detroit is 80% black. So it was like, that's got to be reflected.
It's, yeah.
Because, like I said before, like being black isn't an extra thing. It's not like a fun foible.
Right.
It's who I am. It's who they are. You know, so like instead of that being like an extra little like fun niche, like, oh, look at this guy. This guy's black. So what's a fun music thing that you like? It's like, no, like, so what is music? You know what I mean? Like,
right.
I wanted the perspective to be that Tim and Sam aren't the same race, but that doesn't factor into their friendship at all. You know, because like if you have a black friend, you have a white friend, you don't just sit around and talk about how, hey, man, you're white. Isn't it crazy how white people always do this? Because like you'd never connect, you know?
Right, right.
They just talk about things. They have things in common. So it's not about how they're different. It's about how they're the same. And that doesn't ignore the fact that I'm black, or doesn't ignore the fact that Tim's white, but it's just not the focus. It's not real life to focus on that all the time in a friendship.
So when you were growing up, was there any history of performing or comedy or acting in your family, or was that something you found on your own? Like, how did you find that?
I found it on my own. I'd taken a test to get into a few schools, like Catholic schools, a lot of private Catholic schools in Detroit. So my parents were like, well, why don't you go to U of D? You entered it, you tested in there. You know, all your friends are going there. So it's like, okay, cool. So I got on online and tell my friends, like, I'm staying in town. I'm on AOL, I am. And my friend Hansa is like, oh, cool, Sam, that's great. U of D, huh? Well, how are you going to get used to the uniforms and the ties? And I was like, oh, uniforms and ties, annoying. I'll find a way. She's like, okay, how are you going to get used to being all boys? I was like, no. Because I had gone to like this small middle school with like 15 students. And so like I knew every girl who was like
You needed a fresh pool of talent.
I was ready, you know, I'm in puberty. I'm ready to like get out there and see women, you know. Yeah. So like that was a shock to my system. And I was like just so pissed. Started school year, I was like pissed, angry, annoyed. One day a bus pulls up to the school. And like this girls pile out of the car, out of the bus into the auditorium. And I'm like, where are these girls going? Like, oh, they're going to play auditions. So I was like, I'll be right back. And so I go and I audition for this play.
And that was really the catalyst.
That was like, honestly, and like, cause like to me before that, I just knew movies. I like loved movies and loved performance. I loved comedy cause like I would absorb it so much. Cause like, you know, living between America and Ghana as a kid, like what I had was like movies. I would like just.
Who was your idol?
Bill Murray has been like my idol.
Oh, really?
For so long.
So was it? What was it? Caddyshack or was it Stripes?
It was Ghostbusters.
It was Ghostbusters.
Ghostbusters and then Stripes. I would watch then also. And then What About Bob? But it was Ghostbusters through. I would watch Ghostbusters, maybe twice a week.
Really?
You know, I loved Ghostbusters. I didn't even realize it was funny. I was like, this is just a cool sci-fi movie.
This is kind of horror, kind of sci-fi. I love that's my genre.
You know, that's my genre. I just love horror sci-fi. Then I was like, oh, and as I just grew up, I was like, oh, this is so funny. I remember I was on this trip. My parents would also do tours. So they'd bring people from America to Ghana and like take them around to see Ghana. And there was this high school band that they brought over to like tour Ghana.
Right.
There was this one kid, and I was just telling him about Ghostbusters. And I was just like, and then Ghostbusters does this, and like at Universal Studios, they've got like this Ghostbusters experience, and like you can shoot ghosts, and like my favorite Ghostbusters toy is this. And he was like, stop it, you're so boring. And I'm even to this day, I was like devastated. Because like I loved it so much, and I just would want to talk about it so much.
See, you were just ahead of your time. Now,
exactly.
Everybody geeks out over things.
Everybody geeks out over stuff.
Like, you were ahead of your time.
A geek. I was such a geek. And I was just like narrow focus. I just like, if I love this, I would only like want to talk about this. Why do I want to do this? Like when I loved Ninja Turtles, I would only talk about Ninja Turtles. I always want to like Ninja Turtles. When I love Ghostbusters, only Ghostbusters. G.I. Joe, only G.I. Joe.
So you would go deep on things.
Deep.
So how did that happen with sketch? Like, when did it shift where you said, you know, maybe I don't want to be a dramatic thespian, but I want to, like, what it...
So at the same time as when I went to that audition, I was 14. I had learned about The Second City at the same, like, kind of time. I knew about SNL. I loved SNL. I watched SNL all the time. I knew that all these guys came from Second City. So I went to the audition, made friends there, and one of my friends was taking classes at Second City in Detroit.
So they had classes for younger kids too?
Eventually, they had them like for like 16-year-olds.
Okay.
I think by the time I was 15, I went to see my friend's class show. He was 18, so he was like just old enough to get into the classes. So I went to see his class show, and I was like, this is actually the Second City. This is Second City here. Oh my goodness. So I started going to shows all the time and like watching those things. And I remember one day, they would do this improv jam. So you could, if you're an audience, you could come up and like do like scenes or like do little games. And we do like a conducted story. So the idea is like he'd point to you and you'd like take over the story, and then he'd point somebody else. That person would drop that last word, and the next person would take over from right on that word.
I see.
You know, and then they would go around, and like the trick of it, the trick to it was that like the conductor would like kind of like hint to you that he's coming. So like I knew he, so I was like standing up there, I was like 15, and like he like looked at me and like gave me the point. And I came up with a line, and the audience was like, "Rah!" And I was like, I think this is the future.
What was it about that audience reaction that you think got to you like that?
It was so like real. It was like a real response in the time. Like they didn't know they had to laugh at me. It was a reaction. It was just such a pure reaction. That's why laughter is so great. It's honest, you know? Like you, and that's what's so gross about somebody fake laughing also, is that it's an ingenuine response to like the most genuine thing, or say ingenuine form of the most genuine thing.
Yeah, it's an abomination.
It's an abomination.
Yeah, it's a horrible thing to do.
See somebody like fake, like,
I will never fake laugh again. Telling you that
right
now.
Don't ever fake laugh. It makes me crazy.
It's a disservice to our core humanity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and I myself, I laugh a lot, and I like I smile. I'm a generally cheery person.
Yeah.
So like when I laugh, I laugh. I find things funny. So when I see like a fake laugh, I'm like, do you feel you have to laugh right now? Do you feel like
it's insulting?
It's insulting.
Yeah.
Or do you feel that I am so fragile that I can't have you not laugh at me? Or like, do you feel that like, is it like a social responsibility, or do you feel you have like this need to like provide this laughter, or do you want the attention of laughing? You know, that's another thing too. People like laugh because they're like, look at me, I get this joke.
Yes.
I'm smart, you know?
You know, it's funny, I hear you say that and I go, well, of course then he was drawn to improv because you have to earn a laugh, right? Mm-hmm. It can't be fake. And it seems like to me, the carrot that keeps the people who love improv coming back is that occasionally it transcends anyone's expectations of
yeah.
it, right?
It's such a real moment in the space, and you can't reproduce it, you know? And it doesn't translate to video. It doesn't, you know, you can't tell somebody about it later. It's shared by that audience in that instant and that performer. They are the only ones who will ever experience that moment. That's what's so beautiful about improv, because like you're watching these people create something out of nothing. So like when you laugh, it's a relief, you know? They're like, oh, that is good, you know?
Talk about the psyche it takes to get good at improv, because I would imagine that you'd have to become comfortable with bombing, and I would imagine that'd be tough.
It can be, and it is, because you have to like be ready to eat shit. Like, you simply don't know what works and what doesn't work, and you have to develop this muscle. Like, nobody, like, starts out or as, like, a perfect improviser.
You can't just walk in and be good at
and
it.
Be
you
good
have to
and,
learn.
And you can be funny, but you need to, like, be humble and, like, willing to, like, try something and fail. You need to be able to break out of yourself every time, because, you need to, like, constantly grow. You need to, like, always be learning something. You need to always be listening. You just need to respond honestly. If you are reciting, kind of like dipping into your old bag of tricks, it reads. You can tell. It's like, oh, all right, I can tell you the guy does that joke all the time. But when you find something, you discover it in the moment, you are also, like, excited about it. You know what I mean? And so, like, it comes through, and it just feels real and it feels genuine.
Can you remember a specific instance where you learned something from failing? Like that failure gave you more wisdom about your craft?
Performing at Second City Detroit, it made me, it made Tim, and made everybody who performed at Second City Detroit so strong, because the audiences, like in Second City of Chicago, it's like the, you
the
know.
The tourists come.
The tourists come. Everybody knows. They're like, here we go. This is, we're going to go watch some comedy. I can't wait to enjoy it.
They're ready to go.
They're ready to go. In Detroit, they're like, what is this exactly? They're like, oh, all right. This must be some stand-up. So you're trying to like educate your audience at that time, like to what they're seeing. And they, also, they're not going to give you a laugh if they don't find it funny. You know, so like you develop these skills and like shorthands where you're like, all right, well, I know what works here. I know how to read an audience. I know how to like build on that. And I know you, like you just become so good on the fly and you just know how to perform so well that when we would go from Detroit to Chicago, they were like, these guys have superpowers. I don't know. Why is everybody from Detroit so good?
Because you had a hostile audience.
A hostile audience. We had resistance training, you know?
Yeah.
It was like running underwater. And then you got good, so you can do it.
So when you decided to get serious about this, did it become a thing where there's no plan B, this is what I want to do with my life?
No plan B. Like, my plan B was, like, theater school. It was like I was going to, like, become a... If I didn't make it into comedy, I was going to become the world's most famous dramatic actor.
So the plan B wasn't even a plan B.
It wasn't even a plan B.
It was just
B,
a variation of plan A.
Exactly.
So were your parents okay with that?
My parents have been gung-ho 100%. My entire like career, they've been pretty tremendous.
That's amazing.
It's yeah, and I don't think I would be where I am without that support, because there was never a moment where I was told by them I couldn't do this, and maybe that's what spurs some people, like being told you can't do something, like, oh yeah, I'm gonna try harder, and like you do face that outside of your home base,
because
like this job is nothing but rejection. But just always like knowing that my parents and my mom and my dad are always like, yeah, you love this, do this. You can keep on doing this.
So was your dream to do SNL?
Yeah, it was. I was like, I think I'm gonna do SNL. I was sure of it.
Really?
Kid.
So how did that work out? Did you ever get an audition?
I auditioned twice. I did.
You did? Tell me about that.
Screen tests. So we were performing at Second City, and Lorne Michaels would come and see our shows at Second City. You know, so I did my...
You're in Chicago at this
in
point,
Chicago,
right?
Yeah, my okay. Chicago Second City show. And like I was talking to one of the writers after, it was like, Lorne enjoyed that performance. I think you're probably going to go out and audition for SNL. I was like, oh, okay, cool. I hope so, please. But then the time came, and I did get the call to go out and audition.
So you go to New York.
So go to New York, and they tell you, have three characters, three impressions.
Okay.
So I'm like, I don't do impressions. And so I just put my mind to work, and I just, like, wrote out bits, started performing bits, like, found, like, old, like, things. I was like, what's, like, an old character I did? Okay, this one. And now, like, really puffed that guy out. End up doing, like... 8 characters and like 5 impressions.
For the audition itself.
For this audition. And it's supposed to be 5 minutes.
So how does that work? I mean, are there a bunch of people the same day?
So you get there and they're like, all right, well, your block is from 12 to 4 and you'll be sometime in there. And there's like so many people there. I don't even know exactly how many people were auditioning the same day as me. I'd say maybe like 50.
And are you able to watch them as they go?
You can watch them, but like instead, you don't know when you're going up. You only know when you're on deck. So
okay.
This 4-hour block, you only know 5 minutes before you go up that you're going to go up.
What
so
are the nerves
you're
like?
You're just your dressing room, just going through my 5 minutes, like, great. You never want to let yourself like slow down, because like what if on your 5 minutes you mess up once? You don't want to do that. So you're like, let me make sure that I've got this thing nailed. I don't want my mind to ever waver. So you're just like working yourself up into this frenzy. Then the time comes, you go do your thing. And I remember I got to stage and like I was up on deck. And so I go up and somebody's up on stage. They're singing this song and it's tanking. And I'm like, all the air goes out of me. You know, I'm like, this is a nightmare.
Because you hadn't thought about tanking until you watched someone tank.
So I watched someone tank. I was like, oh, that's real. That's real. They don't laugh. Oh my!
So describe your inner body feelings at this point when you're walking up.
Walking up there, I'm nervous. My hands are shaking. Like, but I'm like trying to set my props on the table, and I'm like, okay, here we go. It's real. The people who are running the audition are like in the back, but like in a little bit shadowy, so you can't exactly see them entirely. You can see them, but not far. And I'm like setting my props. Here we go.
Are you on the stage?
I'm on the stage.
Where they film the show.
Where they do the show. Where they do the monologues.
So that's got to be overwhelming.
Just so much stuff happening. And so I put my like little cheat sheet on the stage. And I'm like, here we go. Slate, say your name. I'm Sam Richardson. And like I remember so well. In that instant, I heard the camera machine go, and that unlocked me. And I was just like, "Oh, this is fine." And I did my five minutes, bum rush. I was like, "I'm Sam Richardson. Here we go." I did my whole thing, blah 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 blah. Didn't even wait, but I heard like laughs in there, and I was like, "Oh, that's great. Okay, cool. That's great. Oh, this is going well. I think blah, 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 blah. Finished. Great."
Do you remember the impressions you did?
I do. I did Barack Obama, where he was like returning, I think, a video to the video store. I did Dr. MLK DDS. It was just Martin Luther King if he was a dentist. And Black History Month.
You have a cavity.
Exactly. You haven't been flossing and you haven't been brushing. That was like a phrase I used, I remember. I did Mr. T.
You did. So it's crazy to think of the pressure of knowing that that's kind of your one shot. It's your 5 minutes, and they're going to make a decision based on those
Based on those 5 minutes. And I'm talking about, like, I just barreled through it, and like afterwards I was like, oh, fine, cool, I did it. And then I remember afterwards Lauren Michaels came up to me, and he was like, oh, Sam, that was really funny. How do you feel? I was like, I feel great. How do you feel? I said. And they just like looked at me and they walked off. And I was like, I think I failed the crazy test. I think I messed up.
Well, in retrospect, what would you have wished you would have said?
It's funny, I'd never thought about that question. I've only just thought about how I messed up. I guess what I wish I had said would have been like, how do you feel? Great, but I know I could do better.
Oh yeah.
You know, I wish I had like the presence of mind.
You always wonder, like, what is it or what is it? So what ends up happening?
So you just wait and you wait and you wait and you wait to hear if you got the job or not. And then one day you read in like the newspaper that they've hired three people and you're like, oh, I'm not one of them. Okay, that's cool.
I mean, was it a heartbreak for you or was that?
It was definitely a disappointment because, you know, I was living in Chicago and like this is the biggest audition. I was like, well, for sure, this is the moment that I've already envisioned for myself. Because like every step of the way, I had done something that I wanted to. I was like, well, I want to be in the touring company of Second City, and then I got to be on the touring company of Second City. I want to be on the main stage of Second City. I was on the main stage of Second City. So like these things are like, oh, I keep on like doing the things. The last step of like what I wanted for myself was to be on SNL. So I was like, here we go. Ooh, if this doesn't work, then what goes?
Does that make some insecurity creep in?
It for sure did. I was like, well, am I not good enough to like, you know, to do this craft? Like I thought I was funny enough. Like I did all the prerequisites in my mind. Not like everybody who's done those things is on SNL. But you know, when you're in that narrow mindset,
that's how you think.
That's like, how you think.
Like I completed all the courses.
I've done it. I've done it. It's been amazing. I've been very lucky. But here we go. One more lucky step, and it's mine. And you know, it didn't happen. And then you kind of resign. You're like, well, maybe I'm not good enough. Well, I mean, I'll keep on doing this. But I have no plan B. You know what I mean?
Right.
I never put a plan B. Like, it just had to be this. So it's like, we'll see. I'll figure out what's going to happen. And so I started doing auditions for like things on for pilots and things in LA, but just putting myself on tape while I was performing at Second City still. And eventually I'd come so close to things that I kind of got the idea of like, well, if I write another show at Second City, I don't know if I'm doing it because I want to do it. I think I'd be doing it because I want to do SNL.
You had to make a break.
I had to make a break. I was like, I think I'm done. I think I'm ready to go. So then I moved out to LA.
And that's, I mean, I think the business term of that is you pivoted, right? You had to make a shift in your business plan, so to speak. So let's jump forward a little bit to Veep, because you happen onto this show that comedically, tone-wise, it's so smart, so different, and there's elements of drama there and comedy, and it's just a different animal completely.
Yeah.
So tell me about that, because maybe for people who don't know, You originally came on just for one episode.
One episode, yeah.
Is that almost approaching that job like a sketch because you're there for one episode and you've got to create a character quickly and...
Yeah, but you want to fill it with as much... but you want that character to be necessary to the story and you want that to be funny. You want it to be good. So like I approached this thing, I was like, well, this will be fun at least. It's such an honor to get to be on this show.
Right.
And I flew out to Baltimore to do the table read for it and then the rehearsal. And I remember I was like looking at, I was reading the script fully on the plane. I was like, I like this a lot. This is so much fun.
Did it seem different? Were you more drawn into this, like hoping that it could turn into something more?
I had no idea that was even like an option.
Oh, you didn't?
You know? I had no idea. So because I didn't know that that sort of thing really happens. So like I just studied this script. I was like, this is funny. I like this character so much. Like I think I know who this guy is. So we went to the table read, and then we're doing the table read. And I'm used to, like, or not used to, but like I wasn't expecting any, like, reaction, you know, because like everybody's done it before, so like you laugh here, but like I was ready to be iced, you know. But I didn't.
Yeah, you're a single episode player. You're in a different category.
You know, yeah. Just do your thing, and I did it, and like they would laugh, and I would laugh, and it was just this fun experience at this table. It was like this is a community. It's like really fun. So then, like after the table read, we put the script aside, and you re-improvise some of the scenes to like make them feel more natural. And it was a scene with me, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, and Kevin Dunn. And it was just fun. Like we were just having fun. We were like just enjoying it.
And is that sort of the working method of that show that there will be, there'll be a scene is written and it gets sort of changed through the rehearsal process?
Through the rehearsal process, exactly. You re-improvise the things or you like find them and then like the writers are there like writing it and it gets folded into the weave of the script. And again, like with the idea of re-improvising, that was my skill set from Second City. So I was like, oh, I can do this. I can find this and I can like put this aside and I can like, I know my character so I can listen.
But how did you know your character? Do you have to do just as much work building and defining a character for one episode as you would have to do for a whole season?
Yes, you do. Like, there's a character description, and when I went into the audition, you know, Armando Iannucci, like, said, well, this is who this character is, and, like, he's this, he's, like, an unfortunately manner. He's, like, he's he's a little bit annoying, but, like, not so good at his job. And I was like, okay. And then it's your job as the actor to then fill in that blank. And you don't want to...
That's a lot of room.
It's a lot of room, but that's like your job, you know? Like as a painter, you fill the space of the canvas, like
yeah.
no matter what. Like even if the blank space is like on purpose, you know? So if as an actor, you're not just like there to like say the words and then be done.
Sure.
So like... You get a backstory, like who's this guy, where's he come from, why is he doing this?
So that's the work we don't ever see.
You don't ever see that.
But that sort of separates the good actors from people who are probably not going to get to that level, is probably that amount of work and that understanding. So how do you go about mapping that out?
What I do is I try and like come up with their, like I'm always just thinking, how are they thinking? You know, so not just what are they saying, but like, when they hear this, what are they ignoring? What are they interpreting this as? You know, like, because I don't think as people even still, like you hear information, it goes through 1,000 filters through your head.
Sure.
You know, so I try and set up those filters as the character to, you know, like how they absorb information and then how they, and how they give information.
It's interesting because I wonder if Richard Splett was originally designed to be so cheerful and, or was that something that added?
I think on the page, I think he was nervous. I think he was meant to be nervous. But I was like, well, this guy, like, what if this guy was nervous, but not really nervous, just over-enthusiastic?
Right.
You know?
Like, because you accidentally created the only likable character in the show.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You sort of stick out like a sore thumb on that show for your attitude towards getting to be in Washington.
Right.
And I think the audience identifies with that, because as much as we can all believe that it's the shit show that Veep portrays it to be, mm-hmm. you can also... there would be an enthusiasm to be there.
Yeah.
That a boyish enthusiasm of being that close to decision making and power and
exactly.
policy.
That's why I say, like, Richard is what if a regular person ended up in DC, but he's a person who believes so much in the power of government through naivete. You know, he's
right.
Like, he believes that everything makes a difference, you know, and like everything makes a difference, not just in policy, but in like how you behave, like how you, he's like nice to everybody because it's like, oh, we don't want to hurt their feelings. Because he like.
Yeah. But the brilliant thing about that show is that they've populated the entire cast with the exception of you as full cynics. So there's no one else that believes that way on the show. They're all completely spiteful over the whole situation, and you're in there. But I mean, I think that you could look at that, and it could be too one note.
Yeah. I think the most interesting thing about a character are their blind spots, the things that they don't know about themselves. You know, but as the actor, you do know those things. But it's about, again, like, absorbing information. What don't they see that is there? You know, I think that's just a funny thing. It's like one of the funniest things about characters. It's like when they are unaware of something about themselves, and so how they behave with that ignorance.
But it seems like it would have to be a dance between the work you're doing and the writers noticing that work and dancing back with you to take full advantage of that, right?
Right. But the writers on that show are pretty tremendous because they see that and they write in that voice that I think we found together on like what a Richard-ism would be, you know, like how he, like, just like, it starts out with maybe with like a blind, like just a casual joke, because like I think it's a character that you can just like tell jokes through.
Right.
But it's got to be made real, you know.
So you have to find, that's the process of finding it, right?
Exactly.
And when you were on that original show, I mean, looking back now, do you think that it's a testament to that show that they noticed something that happened on that one episode between you and Julia that made them want to bring you back? Because I can imagine a show that had too tight control of the reins, not even allowing for that or to pay attention enough to see it.
Right. I think because like the way that show is like they weren't precious about things, you know? So like if I did something that worked, they're like, oh, well, let's lean into that, you know? Let's find what that is, because if it's good, it's good, you know? So they weren't so precious, like, no, shut up, your idea is your idea, but just do this thing.
We have a bigger plan for the show.
We get a bigger idea, because like the show isn't fully written, like, so they're still like, you're still doing those rehearsal processes. So you can find, you know, there's space for a character to grow, which you may not have thought was going to be anything, or there's room to add or lose things in it, you know, it's not just one person's vision where it's like beginning, middle, and end, and this is everything that happens in between. It's beginning, and like there's an overall arc, but it grows and evolves as the show is filmed.
Do you think it's unique in that world, the way not only it's written, but the way that it kind of morphs over the course of the rehearsal and everything? Do you think the show's unique in that way?
I think Veep is unique like that, I believe, because the process, I talk to other actors, I think they just get the script and then they perform the script, you know, or it's that rehearsal process that lets us put ourselves in it as well, which I think is unique to Veep. And like earlier, it used to be that, you know, we had fewer cameras. So the cameras will like find you doing something. So you would have to find something to occupy yourself with. If you're not on camera still, you'd do something, find something to do in that.
A little
that,
documentary style-ish.
You know, yeah.
Okay.
So like the whole time you're invested in that scene from top to bottom because you don't know if what you're doing is gonna get caught. So it's very much like theater, because like on theater, like if you're on stage, the audience is gonna see you. You know, you can't be.
That's right.
You know,
that's
you can't
absolutely
be like,
right.
I'm waiting to my line, and when my line, then everybody's gonna look at me when it's my line. No, you're there the whole time.
Okay, so the level of talent on that show is pretty amazing. Obviously, yeah. Julia Louis-Dreyfus, but between Tony Hale and everybody else in that show, there's a level of comedic royalty.
Yes, for sure.
So when you get asked back and you start becoming more of a regular on the show, do you go through a period of, do I belong here? Because you have less experience. Like, did you ever have that imposter feeling?
That imposter feeling is exactly, and like, it's so, like I had to like forcibly stop myself from having that. Because then it just gets in the way. You know, like, because like being there, like, I had very little TV experience. And, like, it just, like, I think the fit was so natural that they kept on asking me back. But I'm being surrounded by these veterans and like these people who I admire so much, their work, like Kevin Dunn and Gary Cole, you know, Tony Hale and Anna Klumsky. These guys are just so good. Matt Walsh, like, and I won't name everybody.
Matt Walsh started UCB,
Like, so he's the emperor of improv.
Right.
Like, he's this guy's the top of the line.
That's got to be, even to walk onto a set, first off, of a cast that's been doing it for three or four seasons already.
Yeah, exactly.
So they're already a troupe and you're on the outside.
Uh-huh.
I don't know how you get the very thing you need to be great as a comedian, which is confidence.
Right.
When you're faced with that much.
Well, like, it goes back to that notion, like, of, well, you gotta be ready to eat shit, or you gotta be able to try it. You gotta be able to try. So I think my approach to it was like, oh my God, look at this. Look, ignore it, Sam. Just do the best that you can do. And then think about that afterwards, if you think about it at all. But like, if I couldn't in those scenes be like, wow, here's Julia. Okay, Julia's gonna talk to me. Here we go. Couldn't do it. Otherwise, I would be too nervous, you know? So I had to be like, Richard had to be like, this is Selena Meyer. We're two professionals and then we're on this job. And like, now we're in this scene and we're in this scene.
Was that a discipline, like a mantra that you had to actually work at?
I think I developed that when I did The Office. I was on The Office for the last season of The Office.
Right.
And I was just so excited to be on The Office that like I didn't, I felt like I was very much like passive and like I would watch things happen. And I was like, oh, this is cool. Okay, cool. And like, so I would just be thinking about getting my lines right instead of like performing the lines. And like, there's so much happening, and everybody had been there for 9 years, so they were all like, you know, they knew how to, that machine was oiled.
You didn't do all that you could with the experience, were you saying?
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly that. And so like, I think getting the chance to do Veep, like from the beginning, I was like, well, I'm just gonna participate. I'm just gonna do this. Because like, it's any chance you get to perform, any performance that you do is that thing. It's not like a part of a bigger, it is a part of a bigger picture, but in that scene or in that moment, that's the whole thing. You know, so like whatever you bring to it is what you bring to it. Whatever you take from it, you take from it. But like that is what you need to focus on, you know?
Right.
Like you can't be like in a scene and then thinking about what's the next scene, because then you're not performing that scene, you know? Then you're just like going through the motions and like thinking about something else instead of like thinking as that character in that instant who doesn't know something's coming up. And I'll say this also, the scripts can change on the day. So you can't like get too prepped with the script. So you can't go home like and then be like, all right, boom, 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 boom. I'll say it just like this, and then off to the races, because you get to set and they're like, actually this line has changed and this monologue is now gone, but this is a new one. And you'll be stunted because then you're trying to do these new lines and you're only thinking about the old ones. So you have to like have this looseness to yourself, and like you have to, like you learn so quick to learn your lines fast and like perform them and make them feel real. You know, that's... It's a training that I don't think exists anywhere else.
In your real life, out in the world, because you play such a naive character, do you find that people tend to underestimate you a little bit?
I think people do sometimes think that there's not a difference, that I'm just like being myself.
Yeah.
And that is a nice, because like, oh, Richard's such a nice person. But it's also an insult because Richard is so naive and poorly mannered.
Right.
So I think like, it's a compliment in that that you've made this thing so real that it couldn't be a performance. It has to be, you have to just be being yourself.
Right.
So I take that as a positive thing.
Yeah.
That they believe it. Because that's what you're trying to do. You're trying to make somebody believe.
Sure, sure.
The shit you're feeling.
Also, I think that it's always good to be underestimated a little bit.
Yes, and yes, it sure is.
You know?
It sure is.
Because the last thing you want to do is walk in and have everybody go, be like, oh, this is the great Sam Richardson. Let's have him show us what he's got, because it's going to be great.
I know. So, yeah. I really hope everybody does underestimate me. So that if I just do okay, it's...
Well, listen, with the work you're doing on Veep and on Detroiters now, you're not going to be underestimated because you're doing such good work, and I'm a fan, and I really appreciate you coming and doing this.
Thank you so much.
It's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you, Sam.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Hey, folks, that's our show for today. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. If you want to reach out to the show, I'm sam@offcamera.com. You can also check out our Instagram, offcameraShow at Instagram, or me, Sam Jones Pictures at Instagram. We are Sam Jones at Twitter and offcameraShow at Twitter. And most importantly, we are on the web at offcamera.com. If you haven't checked out our store or purchased one of our limited edition magazines, you're really missing out because we make a magazine for each guest and there's exclusive photographs, lots more information in there, and it's a pretty cool way to enjoy the show. And you can get it delivered right to your door. So take a minute and check out the store and check out all the conversations on offcamera.com. There are enough shows there to keep you occupied for days and days. So go deep into our archive, check out the show, and support the show by visiting the store. And I want to thank the people who work on this show, because we wouldn't have a show without these people. Crawford Shippey, Nathan Shields, Michaela Galvin, Laura Kemper, Amy Jones, Matt Davidson, Justin Kennedy, Kara Johnson. These folks all work really hard to bring you this show every week, so a big thank you to them. And be sure to join me next time when I sit down with actress and director Gillian Jacobs.
I felt at that point in my life that now I had to be an actor because I had chosen to go to Juilliard. I was very punctual, very respectful, and I thought that's what was most important. So I was sort of shocked by people doing things that I thought, oh, you'd get fired immediately if you did that in a play. All the things that I had been told were important and valuable were suddenly not important. I hated it.
Her early years were shaped by a somewhat lonely childhood and by almost getting kicked out of Juilliard, where she received zero comedy or improv training. So how does she wind up in NBC's cult comedy community? And even more amazingly, blowing audiences away by playing the most talented improv artist in Mike Birbiglia's Don't Think Twice. Her journey is scary in places, sad in others, occasionally funny, and ultimately inspiring. In other words, it's a damn good story. See you next time, off camera.